Meghan Markle is just the latest of a long line of scandals engulfing the royal family in the past three decades. Much to the Queen's dismay, the so-called Harry and Meghan saga has depicted the royal family in a poor light. The most serious charge relating to allegations of racism, initially directed at Meghan Markle, whose mother is African-American, and then more ominously towards her baby. As Meghan Markle recounted to Oprah Winfrey in the now famous interview in March 2021, an anonymous senior member of the royal family was concerned how brown her baby was going to be. There was widespread speculation that the anonymous racist at the top of the royal family was none other than the new deceased Duke of Edinburgh, husband to Queen Elizabeth for 74 years. The notorious escapades of Princess Diana, wherein the estranged wife of Prince Charles engaged in multiple extramarital affairs, was arguably the first time in modern times that the carefully managed moral reputation of the British royal family was shattered in front of a global audience. Similar to Meghan Markle, the late Princess Diana informed the world of her pain and anguish through a hard-hitting interview with BBC Panorama in November 1995. The description that Diana provided of the royal family nearly three decades ago is eerily similar to its recent depiction by Meghan Markle. Both accounts present the British monarchy as a cold, distant, and unfeeling organisation, which not only demands total obedience from its members, but by extension, it goes to extreme lengths to discredit those who are perceived to have broken the rules. Strategic heavy lift capability. Both Diana and Meghan are perceived to have broken the rules, and very quickly, the two women were ostracised and cast as outsiders. Diana would ultimately pay with her life for daring to criticise and expose royals. And as for Meghan Markle, it remains to be seen what fate awaits her. For if Mohammed Al-Fayed, the billionaire father of Princess Diana's late lover, Dodi Fayed, is to be believed, Princess Diana, alongside her lover Dodi, was murdered by the British Secret Service MI6 on the instructions of the monarchy. The allegations could be dismissed as a conspiracy theory, was the only one making them, but he is not. Even former MI6 officers have made the same allegations, and in the process, supplying credible details to support their incendiary claims. It is now widely suspected that Henry Paul, the deputy head of secretary at Ritz Hotel in Paris, who was driving Diana and her lover Dodi on that fateful late August night, was a long-standing MI6 agent. If indeed the Queen had given a nod and a wink to her Secret Service to deal decisively with the increasingly troublesome Diana, then there was a much bigger message conveyed by that suspected murder. You cross the British monarchy at your own peril.
Your Majesty's guard is ready to march off, ma'am.
To gauge the extent the Queen will go to protect her interests, the best place to start is the great name change of 1917, which enabled the British monarchy to conceal its German roots. By all credible accounts, the great majority of the British people are unaware of the distant roots of the monarchy. Since the accession of Queen Elizabeth II to the throne in 1952, the British establishment has tried hard to depict the monarchy as a quintessentially British institution. However, the reality is very different. The name change from Saxe-Coburg-Gotha to Windsor was effected by King George V at the height of World War I, at a time when the British public were understandably alienated by German names. From this cynical name change, it can be deducted that there is nothing uniquely British about the royal family. Therefore, Tony Blair's assertion that the Queen and her entourage represent continuity in British public life is yet another cynical deception perpetrated against the British people. The Queen may project an image of quintessential Britishness, but it is doubtful that deep down she still doesn't feel a fondness for Germany, not necessarily contemporary liberal Germany, but the Germany of old, specifically the Teutonic way of life of the 19th century. Let's not forget that the longest reigning British monarch, Queen Victoria, who ruled for nearly 64 years, died in the arms of a German emperor, Kaiser Wilhelm II. Who, astonishingly enough, was her grandson on the Isle of Wight in 1901.
As a child, I never imagined that one day a man would walk on the moon.
The royal family reportedly continues to celebrate Christmas the German way by opening presents after afternoon tea on Christmas Eve, which falls on December 24th. By contrast, the British people open presents on Christmas morning, December 25th, typically before breakfast. Although these quirks might be dismissed on the grounds of sentimentalism and nostalgia, but the story gets much more sinister. Britain's shortest reigning monarch, Edward VIII, whose 11th-month reign in 1936 coincided with the policy of appeasement towards Nazi Germany, is a case in point. Edward was well known for his pro-German political sympathies. "Every drop of blood in my veins is German." Edward VIII is reported to have boasted to pro-German activist Diana Mitford, arguably the most accomplished of the notorious Mitford sisters and the then wife of British fascist leader Sir Oswald Mosley. Germany's ambassador to the court of St. James's, the prominent Nazi Joachim von Ribbentrop, who was German foreign minister throughout World War II, even called Edward V half-German on account of the king's effusive pro-German sympathies, if not his mastery of the German language and cultural mores. Indeed, Edward VIII was no ordinary appeaser, insofar as he actively supported the German cause in the 1930s. His support for Nazi Germany started very early, no later than the foundation of the Nazi regime in 1933, when as Prince Edward he encouraged the young princesses, Margaret and Elizabeth, to give Nazi salutes while on a visit to Germany. It is equally noteworthy that, like his brother before him, King George VI was an admirer of Hitler and the Nazis, and an active supporter of the policy of appeasement, which historians blame for the outbreak of war in Europe in September 1939. It has often been said that had Edward VIII been an ordinary citizen, he would most likely have been charged with his treason and swiftly executed following the conclusion of World War II in Europe in May 1945. Another element of Britishness is, without doubt, the Treason Act of 1351, one of the oldest pieces of legislation still on the statute books. At the same time, this ancient law is emblematic of the royal family's disregard, if not contempt, for the body of ancient English laws which it claims to uphold. One quirk of this ancient law is that it constitutes high treason to violate the wife of the king's eldest son, or in contemporary terms, the queen's son, which in this case happens to be Prince Charles. Based on this law, multiple prosecutions could have been launched against the various men, notably Army Major James Hewitt, who entered into consensual romantic and sexual liaisons with the late Princess Diana, the wife to heir apparent to the throne, Prince Charles. Despite her widespread popular appeal, Princess Diana was known to be promiscuous and had affairs with multiple men, including James Gilby, the heir to a large gin fortune, Etonian art dealer Oliver Hoare, rugby player Will Carling, the Pakistani heart and lung surgeon, Hasnat Khan. There were even rumors she had an affair with John Kennedy Jr., the late son of John F. Kennedy. Incidentally, until 1814, the penalty for high treason was death by hanging, drawing and quartering, thereafter reduced to death by hanging. Ignoring the Treason Act indicates that the British monarchy is more than willing and able to engage in legal manoeuvrings, even to the extent of seriously compromising the rich tapestry of ancient and modern laws and norms which underpin the UK's unwritten constitution in order to stay afloat. The Princess Diana saga, which only concluded with her untimely death in 1997, is just one example amongst many. Prince Andrew is yet another and much more contemporaneous example. The errant prince is wanted in the US for questioning in relation to the Jeffrey Epstein scandal, which saw multiple underage girls abused by the deceased American financier. Prince Andrew, or until very recently the Duke of York to give him his formal royal title, was a close confidant of the American paedophile Jeffrey Epstein, who chose to commit suicide in a lonely prison cell instead of facing the music for his shocking crimes. The Duke of York abused his royal privilege for more than 2 years to avoid accountability in a formal setting, and all the while the Queen said nothing about the whole sordid affair, before she finally caved in to public pressure and stripped her son of all titles and charities. But then again, Prince Andrew has form when it comes to corruption and scandal. Dubbed Air Miles Andy on account of his extravagant travelling arrangements, it is reported that in 2003 alone, he racked up £325,000 flying around the world, including using a helicopter to fly to Oxford and misusing RAF planes to fly to Scotland to play golf. To make matters worse, his former wife, the scandal-prone Sarah Ferguson, caused deep embarrassment to the Queen when she was exposed by a News of the World sting operation in 2010, in which she promised to arrange access to Prince Andrew, who was then the UK's special trade envoy, in exchange for £500,000 in cash. The royal family has struggled with issues of nationality and political allegiance. It could be said they have an easier relationship with religion and religious identity. Easier in the sense that the Act of Settlement 1701, whose cardinal aim was to ensure a Protestant succession to the English throne, places a prohibition on Catholics ascending to the crown as kings or queens. Astonishingly, this act is still religiously adhered to, and the British monarch is presented as defender of the faith, as in Protestantism. But the offence and discrimination this act inflicts is no longer limited to Roman Catholics, as the demographic and cultural diversity of Britain has hugely expanded since the early 1950s. Modern Britain is home to millions of people of non-Christian backgrounds, notably Muslims and Hindus. Since the early 1980s, the British government, in tandem with large business organisations and civil society writ large, has gone out of its way to place diversity at the pivot of its domestic policies. This attitude has given rise to an idiosyncratic British concept of multiculturalism, which purports to promote equality of opportunity amongst the UK's diverse demographic groups. But is the Queen's status of defender of the faith consistent with this policy? More broadly, the religious issue, although highly symbolic, is just one example among many where the Queen is seriously out of step with developments in British society. To to properly integrate. This disparity in world values in British society, the best place to start is the political realm. The UK likes to project itself as the world's oldest democracy, taking special pride in its parliamentary roots.
Hundreds of respondents took part in the Stoke-on-Trent...
Supporters of the British establishment never tire of reminding the world that their core parliament, the House of Commons, is the oldest such institution in the world. This is a myth, of course, as there are many ancient parliaments out there, such as the Swedish Parliament or the Riksdag, some of which predate the House of Commons by decades and even centuries. Pedantic disputes aside, the modern House of Commons is generally recognised as a democratic institution, as demonstrated by the rigorous selection and election processes, which take place before someone from whichever political party takes up his or her place in Parliament. And yet these very same people have to not only swear an oath of allegiance to an unelected monarch, but worse still, throughout their tenure, they are forced to demonstrate defence to the royal family, often against their own best judgment. At least for the past 120 years, there have been professed Republicans who are against the monarchy establishment in the House of Commons and, lesser still, in the House of Lords. There are not many of them, but the fact they are there and are forced to swear an oath of allegiance to the Queen introduces a degree of hypocrisy into the British political process.
I swear by Almighty God that I will be faithful and bear true allegiance to Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth, her heirs and successors according to law.
Worse still, the fact that MPs are forced to swear an oath of allegiance to the Queen is the strongest indicator that all legal and constitutional means for removing the Queen and the royal family have been closed off. Short of a revolution, the British people simply cannot overthrow their unelected rulers. The Queen, of course, does not reciprocate in kind, insofar as she does not swear an oath to uphold parliamentary democracy, let alone serving the people. But the real picture is much worse than that, inasmuch as every major British institution, from the military down to the prison system, is trapped in this unreciprocated oath of allegiance. On account of this comprehensive hegemony, how can stalwarts of the British establishment claim the Queen is bereft of political power and yet keep a straight face at the same time? At this juncture, it is necessary to gauge an accurate picture of the extent of the Queen's powers. Just how powerful is she, and to what extent can the monarchy affect the tide of British destiny? The simple answer, of course, is that the Queen and her heirs have tremendous powers which affect the daily lives of Britons and, to a lesser extent, the citizens of those countries where the Queen is still nominally head of state, notably Canada, Australia and New Zealand. In keeping with British tradition, where subtlety and discretion are prized characteristics, the monarchy exercises political power through ancient and seemingly innocuous-sounding institutions. One such institution is the Privy Council, officially a body comprised of senior politicians whose job is to advise the Queen on the exercise of the royal prerogative. For one thing, the Privy Council remains a secretive arm of the state, with a set of traditions and rituals that come close to Masonic theatrics. And at the centre of its official business is the Queen herself, who is physically present every time the Council meets to utter the words approved or referred in order to direct or influence policy proposals. In short, the Privy Council constitutes the principal vehicle by which the royal prerogative is enforced. In the words of the former Liberal Democrat MP turned establishment critic, Norman Baker, The Privy Council is effectively a one-person law-making, decision-taking machine. The royal prerogative, whose spirit and functions are embodied in the Privy Council, has multiple layers, with each layer in turn producing multiple, if not countless, powers and privileges. For instance, the prerogative of perfection is a function which confers personal immunity on the sovereign from ever being sued in the courts. The Queen is quite literally above the law. If the Privy Council represents the hard edge of the Queen's far-reaching powers, then the honours system constitutes the soft core of her barely concealed, all-encompassing influence. Going back all the way to 1348, with the establishment of the Order of Chivalry against the backdrop of the Black Death Plague, Britain's honours system enables the Queen to maintain the country's social and economic hierarchy. By doling out honours, indirectly by way of the government, the Queen confers favours and recognition to those whom she approves of. Officially designed to distinguish between different degrees of achievement and service, the honours system actually performs the opposite by conferring recognition on those the establishment, and by extension the Queen, seeks to promote and elevate. But the honours system, like every feature of British public life, is vulnerable to deep corruption. In the Cash for Honours scandal of 2006 to 2007, for instance, honours and peerages for the House of Lords were offered to individuals who had made large financial donations to the then-ruling Labour Party. The Queen clearly knew about the corruption, but for reasons of political expediency, or some other consideration, she chose to turn a blind eye to it. In one of the latest controversial examples, the Queen directly bestowed knighthood to former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, regarded by many as a war criminal for his role in waging the 2003 Iraq War. The story of the real royals does not stop there.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked as
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulema's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a shorter speech by Hojatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
هست که خداوند متعال به حضرت موسی فرمود که یا موسی یک موجودی رو که از خودت پستر هست.
It is narrated that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala asked Prophet Moses to bring him a creature lower than himself. By such a request, Allah wanted to examine Moses, a divine test. Prophet Moses obeyed and went out to fight a human lower than himself in rank. However, wherever he looked, he couldn't find such a creature. Allah told Prophet Moses, "O Moses, if you brought someone to us, you would lose your rank of prophethood." The lesson we take from this request of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the reaction of Prophet Moses is that we must not consider ourselves higher than others in our lives. Every creature has a benefit. One good example was the late Ayatollah Bahaudini. He always considered himself the lowest among all, and when he was invited to a gathering, he used to sit down at the entrance or the least cited place of the room. His high status and knowledge never let him be proud or arrogant.
یا عالم دینی پیغمبر فرمود اگه توقع داشته باشه مردم جلو پاش بلنشن.
Prophet Muhammad stated, "A religious scholar and alim must never expect the people to rise at his arrival or to obey him like a servant. If he does so, he must wait for the hellfire in the other world." Of course, the people must respect their religious authorities too. However, this respect must not lead into arrogance or self-centrism of the scholar. Therefore, modesty and sense of humbleness is required for all the people, especially the scholars and ulama. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hojatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en, Kalav Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Thank you. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A highly embarrassed President Joe Biden, after wrongly claiming that he was committed to helping Latin America and the Caribbean recover from the COVID-19 pandemic, tackle irregular migration and improve living standards, had to sheepishly hear many of his counterparts from the Hispanic world lash at his lies. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kahan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading U.S. Isolated on Its Own Turf. Stay tuned for more. Whatever is left of the plummeting U.S. credibility in its own geographical area took a further nosedive at the summit of the Americas Summit in Los Angeles, when even the attendees at the heavily boycotted gathering blasted Washington for its affront to humanity. A highly embarrassed President Joe Biden, after wrongly claiming that he was committed to helping Latin America and the Caribbean recover from the COVID-19 pandemic, tackle irregular migration and improve living standards, had to sheepishly hear many of his counterparts from the Hispanic world lash at his lies. Biden, who violated the charter of the Summit of the Americas by excluding the leaders of Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela from the week-long gathering, thereby prompting the leaders of Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, Bolivia, El Salvador, and Haiti to boycott the event, found himself isolated on his own home turf. Biden harping on democracy in the Western Hemisphere, despite the U.S. record of undermining and overthrowing elected governments in Latin America and all over the world, was challenged by Prime Minister John Briceño of Belize, who said, "The future of the Western Hemisphere is a question for all countries of this region, irrespective of their size, their GDP, and system of governance, in order to ensure a sustainable and equitable future. But isn't it inexcusable that all countries of the Americas are not here and the power of the summit dismissed by their absence?" He said the fact that any Latin American country not being invited to the Summit of the Americas was incomprehensible, and in particular not inviting Venezuela was unforgivable. Briceño also criticized the decades-long U.S. economic blockade of Cuba. He was followed at the podium by President Alberto Fernandez of Argentina, who lashed out at the U.S. and called for a change in the rules that allowed Biden, as the host of the summit, to decide who was invited to the gathering. Earlier, Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador had slammed the U.S. for its policy of exclusion, warning Washington that it needed to change its desire to dominate the world. López Obrador, who turned down Biden's invitation to attend the summit because of the U.S. refusal to invite the leaders of Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua, had made it clear there cannot be a summit of Americas if not all of the continent's countries participate. It is to be noted that U.S. officials had spent weeks trying to find a way to entice President López Obrador to the summit in Los Angeles, but failed. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris could not succeed in persuading the leader of Honduras to come, while the leaders of El Salvador and Guatemala declined Biden's invitation. El Salvador's president, Nayib Bukele, would not even get on the phone despite frequent calls from U.S. Secretary of State Antony J. Blinken. This is indeed humiliation for the U.S. and a personal blow to Biden, who ought to realize that the days when Latin America was viewed as Washington's backyard are over.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray five times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Azam, ghayru din Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about the rules, Islamic jurisprudential laws about the media, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini. The son of Ayatollah Ha'iri, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'iri, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and as always, our guest speaker, Sheikh Javid. Let's talk about some of the questions and concepts about media, jurisprudentially speaking, of course, according to the rulings of Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, in wedding parties, all right?
Yes.
We know that, especially with the advent of technologies today, everybody's, having cell phones, mobiles, and maybe even a couple of them in their pockets. So they go anywhere with that, and let alone wedding parties and marriage ceremonies, Is it permissible for women to take pictures of themselves, all right,
yes,
without the permission of their husband? If your answer is yes, then, assuming that is permissible, is it obligatory to observe proper hijab in their weddings?
Well, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, taking photos per se does not depend on the permission of the husband.
Mm-hmm.
A woman can exercise her right as a woman, as an individual with a free will, to take pictures of herself or to allow other people to take her picture. It is permissible per se. But if there is a possibility that non-mahram men may see her pictures, and that not observing proper hijab could lead to a bad deed or let's say to a negative consequence,
mm-hmm,
then she should observe hijab, or she should, avoid taking pictures or allowing other people to take. And, as it is usually the case,
right,
pictures which are taken by other people or pictures in modern time and this time around, pictures are usually posted on YouTube channels or social networks, and they are exploited, misused. So if there is such possibility, one should avoid posting one's own picture on, mm-hmm, on social networks, because
right,
there is a possibility that these pictures might end up falling in the hands of people who might want to misuse these pictures.
Mm-hmm. I see. What about
this kind of covering, as you can see, like especially the brides, you know, cover themselves with, it's a, some kind of like, you know, wedding dress, basically. It's a part of the wedding dress. And it looks like a net, basically. It's a light, transparent garment or veil.
Yes.
All right? And in wedding parties, it's quite normal for the brides to wear such, you know, gowns, such dresses. All right? Is it permissible for them to, let's say, to, even for a non-mahram man to take a picture of the bride, as is sometimes the case in such wedding parties where there is a camera person, you know, and normally it's a non-mahram, basically, camera person.
You're right. Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that if taking pictures entail haram, haram looking, you know, haram looking is haram. So if taking pictures entail haram looking, at a non-mahram woman, it is not permissible.
Right.
And usually when for example, a man enters into a wedding hall and goes in stands in the midst of women or in front of women taking their pictures, he's inevitably, or maybe he cannot help getting aroused. And so it is the kind of, it is definitely haram for a woman to take pictures of women who are wearing see-through clothes or gowns, which are kind of, which are revealing, actually. And on the other hand, women wedding parties are wearing makeup, and it's not permissible for a woman, for a man to enter and to go into the wedding hall and into the room where women are there with their makeup on. So it's not permissible, and it definitely leads to some kind of evil, some kind of evil deeds.
I see. Okay, Shostovit, let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our questions and answers of the media according to Ayatollah Khamenei on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about the media, or the rules about the media according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, is it permissible for women to watch men's wrestling?
Well, it is not permissible for a woman to go to, let's say, to a ring. Let's say there is a ring, the men are wrestling, and a woman wishes to go and see the wrestling competition from close. It is not permissible, definitely. And also, if the picture is broadcast live, and a woman wishes to watch men wrestling, because the clothes are very tight, they are they reveal the shape of the body, it's not permissible for a woman to watch these pictures and these movies. Obviously, you know, it's not only about wrestling, but there are also other competitions. Men do not wear, you know, clothes, covering clothes, and the body is, but their bodies are partially unclothed, uncovered. So if a woman has some kind of lustful intention, it is not permissible to watch them. And it's not permissible if the watching is, you know, done by by attending the ring,
mm-hmm.
and with lustful intention, and you know, the questionable thoughts. Sometimes you might have a thought which is problematic, you know, or if there is fear of falling into a kind of sin, or feeling fear of falling victim to the temptation. Of course, it's not permissible. And of course, our Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that watching such, you know, wrestling or let's say competition through live television broadcast is not permissible as a measure of obligatory precaution. Otherwise, there's no harm in it. There's no problem in it.
Sheikh Javed, you know, what is the ruling about taking pictures or photos of women mingling with their mahrams? We all know that not everyone is a photographer. They don't have the right proper equipment to develop the negatives.
Yes.
So they have to give the negatives and films to a photographer with the proper equipment to develop and print it, right? So is it permissible for this kind of picture to be taken?
His Eminence says that there is no problem if the photographer who looks at them to take pictures is one of their mahrams. That is for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Because a mahram is taking picture of a mahram. And in unmarried, mahram is a person who is unmarriageable under any circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the definition of a mahram. If someone is mahram to you, you cannot marry him or her, let's say marry her, under any circumstances.
Right.
So if the picture is taken by a mahram, there is no problem. And there should also be, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, no problem in developing and printing
mm-hmm.
those pictures by a person who does not know them. You know, it is very much important to differentiate between knowing someone and not knowing someone. If you are developing someone's picture who is unknown to you, you don't know where he or she lives and where they are, who the picture belongs to, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So it is permissible to print it, to develop it, and then print it.
Yes,
of course. But if you know someone, a woman living in your street or in your alley,
mm-hmm.
and you know who that girl is and who her father is, and you are developing it, of course, it's not permissible to develop and print her picture.
My appreciations, Sheikh Javed. Thank you for your contribution
to
the program.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome. And thank you, my dear listener, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. This program, we are talking about the media or the rules of about the media according to Ayatollah Khamenei in this program Islamic Laws. Thank you very much for listening. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.